Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of the Little Dudes Insect Academy podcast. I am here for a new episode for you all, talking with my new friend Cord. So without further ado, let's just jump right into this. Welcome to the show, Cord. Go ahead and introduce yourself for us.
Hi, yeah, my name is Cord Dickey. I am actually recently changed to PhD student at Colorado State University. My program is in ecology, but obviously this is an entomology podcast, so I do some entomology basis. So more specifically, I work with honeybees, and I would consider myself a behavioral ecologist. So more generally, I just look at the behavior of honeybees, but like more in depth. So I look at what you would call the metabolic theory of ecology and pace of life theory and apply those frameworks to honeybees. So basically looking at how honeybee metabolic rate drives their behavior, life history, and physiology.
Wow. Yeah. So, I mean, let's just dive right into that. What are all of those, theories, and just dive right into what all of that means for us?
Yeah. So the first one I mentioned, metabolic theory of ecology, it's kind of like this recently, I think by recent, I mean like 2006, the theory was kind of started to get developed. And basically the idea that, so metabolic rate is, if people are familiar, just like kind of all the energy processes that goes on within an individual organism. Mm-hmm. So the concept behind that is your metabolic rate, how fast these reactions are happening within your body will drive a whole bunch of things down the line. So it'll drive things in your behavior, drive your life history or your physiology. And so that's kind of the concept, the base framework behind metabolic theory of ecology. And more specifically, they have actually found that metabolic rate scales really like across different animal kingdoms, not just insects, but mammals, birds, whatever. It's their metabolic rate scales with their body size. So the larger your body, the lower your mass specific metabolic rate is. So that's just controlling for, so like an elephant's mass specific metabolic rate is going to be a lot lower than a honeybee's. And then, so that's that first theory, just looking at how metabolic rate affects and plays an underlying role in behavior, life history, and whatnot. Pace of life theory takes that one step further. And this is, so I'm going to put this in the framework of like honeybees, because it's kind of what I do. So pace of life is the idea that an individual falls somewhere along a slow and fast axis in terms of like slow and fast behavior, slow and fast metabolic rate, and whatnot. So if people have heard of RNK selection, it's kind of the same idea. But so slow metabolic rate individuals or slow pace of life individuals, those individuals like honeybees would have a longer lifespan. They would have a lower metabolic rate. They would have basically the suite of correlated traits. So they'd have a whole bunch of correlated traits that can place them along a slow and fast axis. So you would say this honey compared to this honeybee or a different honeybee would be a slow bee compared to a fast bee.
Yeah. So you're not only measuring the metabolic rate of honeybees in general, but you're also measuring the individuals. Is that correct?
Yeah. So with honeybees, the really interesting thing is because they're social, you can either measure like their entire colony or entire group or the individual.
Right.
It's much easier to do like what you just said, the individual honeybee, and just measure that metabolic rate. It's much, much more difficult to just then do a group. And then the hardest experiment to do would be a colony level experiment where you measure the entire metabolic rate, which I have not been able to do yet, but it's something I'm very interested in.
Yeah, so from a practical standpoint, how do you measure this rate of the metabolic rate of a honeybee? Like, what kind of goes into that process?
Yeah, so across different insect species, mammals, and whatnot, a common practice in measuring their individual's metabolic rate is how much they breathe, so their respiration. So whether that's measuring how much CO2 they consume or how much sorry, how much oxygen they consume or how much CO2 they breathe out. For insects, typically, you measure CO2. And then for like fish or mammals, it would be more oxygen. And so basically, we put honeybees in a chamber, a closed sealed container, feed that chamber air that is scrubbed of any CO2, so there's no CO2 in it. And then that individual, that honeybee, then would breathe. So then it would emit low levels of CO2. And then you have a machine. We use something called a Fox Box. So just the process called respirometry. And that measures low levels of CO2. And how much you breathe, you can convert to basically a power output. So using basically the unit of watts to get their metabolic rate.
Wow. Yeah. And so we're measuring this metabolic rate. It's quite a process. But how many individuals do you do this for? Individual honeybees? And then do you do this for like other members of the colony as well, like the drone bees and the queens, or just the workers? And then I'm just wondering about that.
So for your first question, so how many? So when we're just doing individuals, I mean, a lot depends on the experiment. But I think my first research season, I did respirometry on over like 500 individuals.
Wow.
And you want to measure their metabolic rate. Like you don't want to just do it once. You gotta be pretty proactive and measure it multiple times, because individuals' metabolic rates can differ, like depending on what they're doing at that time of day. Are they flying? Are they just walking around and whatnot? So typically you do a bunch of individuals. You can't just do one individual. Mm-hmm. And then your second question was what?
What members of the colony do you do this for? Is it just the workers?
Mm-hmm. So generally we just look at the workers. Mm-hmm. They're the ones that we collect, or the easiest to collect. We can also like number tag them. Right. So we know their age and whatnot. Mm-hmm. Drones, we're not really interested in. Like some of your listeners probably know, drones don't really do much in terms of like colony output. So we're interested in measuring like colony survival and colony output. Mm-hmm. Drones don't really contribute much to that, so we don't do much research there. And then queens, I would love to do research with queens. They're just very sensitive, and I don't want to take a queen out of a colony and then piss off the colony and then potentially damage the queen by handling her and then they rejecting her and whatnot. But I do want to get into like actually selective breeding of queens, so breeding queens and rearing queens, which would allow me to have a bigger pool of queens and actually do experiments like that.
Yeah, and you bringing up queen rearing is really interesting, because it just made me think about, do you see any difference in the metabolic rates of the workers colony to colony, or like are they different depending on bloodline or colony or anything like that, or is it all sort of constant?
So that's like exactly what my research does.
Oh, great.
So we actually have identified an allele within honeybees. It's called malate dehydrogenase allele, and it helps with the regulation of ATP. And basically what they found is you have a fast, slow, medium allele, and individuals can have different variations of the fast, slow, and medium, and that determines their kind of their metabolic rate. So you can actually, and what we've done, you can actually breed honeybee queens to have workers that have either fast metabolic rates or slow metabolic rates. And that's what we're interested in, seeing how an entire colony of fast bees, an entire colony of slow bees differ in their metabolic rate, and then how that affects their behavior, their honey output, their survival and whatnot.
Fascinating. Yeah. So, wow. Yeah. Super interesting. And, so that's the purpose of your research. So, tell us a little bit more about like the implications of what this research could mean for like the future of, honeybees in the US.
Yeah. So like there's a whole bunch of research going around, like US, across the world, about like honeybee breeding, like especially like with disease resistance, like with their barrel knife and whatnot.
Yep.
But right now, honeybees are kind of just shipped across the country. Like they're in California, they're in Texas, they're kind of shipped. They're not adapted to their environment at all. And if you're more adapted to your environment, you're going to be better prepared for what that environment throws at you, and you'll have overall better success. And so what we want to figure out, and this would be, we don't know yet, but we want to figure out is if fast or slow colonies, or maybe a mix, some certain mix of those, do better in certain environments. So there's been research in the past that showed there's actually a latitudinal gradient of that allele I was talking about. So basically, in more northern populations, there's more slow alleles than fast alleles, which kind of, and this was back in the 80s or something, when bees were not as, well, when bees were adapted to the environment and not as, they weren't shipped all over the place.
Yeah.
So that kind of gives the idea that, okay, maybe there's some selection happening, and that slow metabolic rate bees do better in colder or northern environments. So the implication is if we can find that slow bees or fast bees do better in a warm or cold environment, then we can breed those bees for those environments. And then the overall honey production, the pollination, or just the overall survivability of those bees would be increased in those areas.
Wow. Yeah, that is super interesting to think about because, you know, I'm in the north, I'm in Washington State, where, and I've kept honeybees in the past, and, you know, there's this local, you know, place where a lot of beekeepers get their bees in the spring, and they get their bees from California. So they, you know, they take a big trailer down to California and bring all the bees back. And, you know, California is a very different climate from Washington. We have a much harsher winter, much more moisture, which is a big issue. And that's super interesting to think about that, you know, we're getting the bees from California, so they're not going to be adapted to Washington or any other place that, you know, I think, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think majority of the commercial bees are from California if you're a beekeeper in the U.S. Yeah, so that is super interesting to think about. And then, so I've been trying, I've tried to get my bees from Eastern Washington breeders instead, which I've done in the past, and that seems to work pretty well. Super, super interesting work you're doing. So yeah, so to find this allele that you're talking about, do you, you do quite a bit of DNA sequencing also to find it, or is there sort of, is there a presence of it in all bees?
I mean, so there's a, I don't know about all bees in terms of like beyond honeybees.
Right.
But for honeybees at least, so we've actually been trying to develop this DNA assay. What we actually do is we do this basically protein electrophoresis. So now, right now we are able to just identify it based off this protein assay, protein-based assay. But that involves killing the bee. Like we have to kill it to get that protein. So we're trying to do a DNA assay, in which case we can just kind of snip the wing of a queen, which does not, and so a lot of beekeepers already clip the wings of queens to prevent them from flying away. So this would have already happened. So then we would use that genetic material from the wing to identify that allele. We ran into some difficulties. Actually, there's only a single nucleotide difference between the fast and the slow allele. So we ran into some difficulties, but we're, this is our second year doing it, and we're making some progress, and hopefully we can get that DNA assay figured out. But yes, so we do a decent amount of like wet lab DNA protein-based work.
Yeah, so this is super interesting. Yeah, so I mean, sort of departing from this a little bit, this is sort of a, you know, controversial push-button topic right now, but, you know, a lot of people have opinions about, you know, the role of honeybees in our habitats. So what are your viewpoints on that? Like, a lot of people say, you know, save the bees but not the honeybees, or Like they say that the honeybees outcompete the native bees. What are your thoughts on that being a, I guess, a specialist in the honeybee, the world of honeybees?
Yeah, that's a great question because like in my program itself, so like ecology itself, I have a bunch of other researchers that are native bee researchers. And they're obviously advocating for the native bees and they don't like honeybees at all.
Right.
So I obviously work with honeybees, so I'm a little bit biased in that aspect.
Yeah.
But personally, I think it would be great if native bees could just come in and take the role that honeybees do.
Mm-hmm.
I just feasibly don't think realistically that's possible. Maybe you can gradually move off of it, but in terms of honeybees being such a generalist and already being distributed,
yeah,
and us being able to basically domesticate them and ship them where we need them,
mm-hmm.
That's not something that we can easily replicate with native bees. And I question if we just try and get rid of native honeybees and try and use native bees, we might just try and find a different native bee that is also a generalist and then do the exact same thing to some extent
mm-hmm.
that we did with honeybees.
Now takes the role of the honeybees, right?
Exactly. So although I wish an ideal world, it'd be great if we just had a bunch of native bees and honeybees, we had less reliance on honeybees. I don't think that's possible. I believe it should be more stressed to be, instead of like, don't save the honeybees, it should be just, how about preserving native bee habitat instead of like destroying it for like monoculture and whatnot.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it's a big, controversial sort of issue right now. And it has been for a while. But yeah, I agree with you with that for sure. And I think they're sort of here to stay. I mean, they've been here so long that they're almost endemic to the U.S. at least. I think there's no getting rid of them. And I think also that aspect you talked about of shipping them and, you know, being able to put them where we need them for agricultural purposes is also really beneficial because we could distribute them where we need them and it's not going to be... you know, they're likely already there if it's in the U.S. So, yeah, really great. Yeah, so moving on to a little more about you, Cord. First of all, where did you go to school and where are you in that process? And what are some of the things that you worked on through that so far?
So for my undergrad, I went to the University of Arizona down in Tucson. I got a degree in environmental science and I had an emphasis in biology. It wasn't necessarily like entomology based. Mm-hmm. Like I always wanted to do entomology, but I kind of always knew I wanted to do grad school as well. So I'm in grad school currently at Colorado State University.
Okay.
So my undergrad was kind of just like, oh, I kind of need it. I'll put it in some sort of scientific background that I'm interested in. And environmental science gave me a really great background of just becoming a well-rounded scientist, which mm-hmm. I think is really important. Mm-hmm. You don't just want to be super specialized in your one organism of study and not know anything out of your field.
Mm-hmm.
So there I did have a little bit of entomology based. I did a internship with there's a handful of USDA bee labs across the country, and one of them happens to be in Tucson, Arizona. So I did an internship there in which I actually looked at honeybee diet and behavior. So kind of along the lines of what I do now. And so then essentially we just looked at brain luminosity. So looking at how different parts of the brain activate based on what type of diet. But that was undergrad. I was kind of low on the totem pole in terms of that research.
Right.
But that was kind of my undergrad work. And then now I'm in my third year of my PhD. I was actually a master's student up until probably a month ago.
Wow.
So I went in just one of my master's. And one thing about if people do honeybee research or a lot of insect research, there's a field season. Most of the time you can't do it during the winter. Or if you can only do it in the winter, you can only do it in the summer. So that increases your stay at whatever university or institution you're at. Mm-hmm. So I can only do research in the summer. I've done two field seasons. So this would be essentially what you'd call like two chapters. And I'll need at least four. So two more field seasons before I have an idea about graduation or anything like that.
Yeah, very cool. Wow. Yeah. And for the, I mean, we'll talk a little bit about your future plans in a minute, but you're thinking of continuing this honeybee research or at least similar for your PhD moving forward, or are you sort of shifting at all?
I'm definitely trying to continue. So actually originally I applied to this lab and I wanted to do a colony level experiment. So you kind of mentioned measuring like colony level traits, colony level metabolic rate. Mm-hmm. So that's the first summer what I wanted to do. I wanted to look at this colony level traits. But in order to do that, we need to get those, what we're calling metabolic lines. So those entire colonies of slow bees and entire colonies of fast bees. Mm-hmm. So you need to be able to selectively breed those queens. And we've had difficulties with, it's very acquired skill. No one in our lab can do it. We outsourced to like other universities and specialists. So it's been difficult. So I haven't been able to do that one experiment that I came here for. I've done two different side experiments. Mm-hmm. So I would have been graduating at the end of this coming semester with my master's.
Right.
I want to do that experiment. I like the position I'm in. So hopefully I get to do it this summer and continuing along those lines. Actually, my last experiment might actually go. So I work generally with the European honeybee, but my advisor has connections in India and I might be able to go do some Asian honeybee work. So there's three other species of Apis. So honeybees Apis mellifera. Mm-hmm. So there's Apis dorsata, Apis serrana, and I'm forgetting the other one. There's four of them. And so I might be able to go to India and do some research with them. And there's not much research with those species. So it'd be super cool to do that.
Wow. Yeah. Interesting. And India has probably a little bit of a better field season, right? Lengthwise.
Oh yeah. But, those species aren't like a honeybee. So a honeybee, two of them don't nest in cavities. They're open nesters.
Oh.
So you'll just see a ball of bees in a tree. And they also, some of them, so their behavior is not as well documented. Mm. Random things happen. So if random things happen in honeybees, you just go online and look it up.
Yeah.
Random things happen to colonies there, or mm-hmm. those species, you kind of don't know what to do. Mm. You just kind of, there's some research, but not much. So there's pros and cons to that. But some are migratory as well. So you talk about that. The field season's longer, but you have to follow them.
Mm. Yeah, and so they're not considered honeybees, is that right?
They're honeybees.
Okay.
But
they're not the European honeybee.
Yeah, so what people always think of as the European honeybee, the pictures I'm sure everyone's seen,
yep.
That's all the European honeybee. That's not the Asian honeybee.
Mm. Yeah, and so they do produce honey, right? Are there beekeepers there? Like, do people keep these bees like they do in the U.S.?
Two of them, I'm blanking on which two. I think Dorsata is a smaller one. I think maybe it's Apis serrana is the one that is most similar to Apis mellifera, which mm-hmm. is what we call the European honeybee. Mm-hmm. And those bees have been slightly domesticated there. So there mm-hmm. are some beekeepers, and you can actually buy them. So they're kind of like the European honeybee. The other two, however, no, those are the open nesters. They're really hard to work with. They mm-hmm. don't cooperate. You can't just throw them in a box, right? Because mm-hmm. they're open nesters. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay. I haven't really done any research on, those other species of honeybee, but, super interesting. And that would be really cool. If you could go do that, super interesting. And, I think important work just for the health of our, honeybees in general. So super exciting stuff. Yeah. So, moving on to a little bit more about you, how did you originally get into entomology, and When did that happen? Like, was it a specific moment, or have you sort of always been interested in them?
I would say I've kind of like always been interested in them. I don't know if I'd be considered a weird kid, but like I wanted to be an entomologist before I could spell entomologist. I was probably, I don't know. I think I remember in like second or third grade, people wanted to be firefighters. I wanted to be an entomologist. Didn't know how to spell it. Just wanted to work with insects. So I kind of always wanted to do that. I had like the classical like ant farms that I love to work with. I used to like stand over ant piles and just watch them. And I would like pick an ant up and then drop it and notice that like they kind of attacked it for a second, but then they left it alone because they realized like it's like, oh, that belongs to us. I thought it was really interesting. So I would just say from a very young age, I was really interested in just insects and specifically social insects. So like watching ants, I couldn't watch bees as much, but I found it interesting just the social aspect of that.
Yeah, that's awesome. I sort of have a similar story with that. Always been into it. I love to hear that. It begs the question, do you have like a, were you ever into collecting them, or were you sort of more observational, or do you have an insect collection still?
So I never pinned insects myself. That's what kind of what you're getting at it. I do have like a bunch of insect related, not only apparel. I do have some pinned insects like butterflies and some beetles, but I didn't pin them myself. It would be something I'd love to get into. I just never, I don't know, got around to it. And I grew up in Arizona, and I feel like it would be cool to go around, but there's a lot of things I want to kill you up in Arizona, especially at night. So you got to kind of watch where you step. I don't have any collections or anything like that. I dissected a million different types of insects as a kid, sadly, to their own pain. But I don't do that. Now I make sure I freeze them and kill them as ethically as possible.
Yeah, awesome. I love that. Who sort of like have helped you along your journey? Like, who's your inspiration, and who do you look up to either in the scientific world or just in life in general?
Yeah, so one of the things that like I was always like thought was cool, I don't think this necessarily played a role in me liking insects, maybe like etched me along a little bit more, was so my name, I'm actually named after my great grandfather, who was an entomologist.
Oh, cool.
So like I would like to think my name's fairly unique, and so I got it from him, and just ironically he was an entomologist and I want to be an entomologist.
That's awesome.
So that's kind of the first person that was like, I thought it was kind of cool to want to do the same thing as someone you're named after. But in terms of like, so that was like my younger inspiration. I didn't have anyone I necessarily looked up to, like in terms of entomologists growing up. But nowadays, I have a great relationship with my advisor, the person that runs my lab. He really showed me like the kind of work ethic you need and the background information, and who's pretty much always there whenever I need him. So he's, and I can recommend to anyone who's ever thinking about it, make sure you have a good PI is what you call it, or advisor. It helps so much. And then more recently, I've worked with some scientists at the USDA lab in Baton Rouge, really cool, like breeding lab. If people want to check it out or look into it. And they've been great resources for me as well, especially if anyone wants to get into like government jobs or entomology related to government jobs, get into connections, and those people are always super nice and willing to talk to anybody.
Yeah, really cool. I love to hear that. So what are some of your other like passions and activities and hobbies that you enjoy in your spare time, whether it's entomology related or not?
So not entomology related. I am really into soccer. So
Nice.
I played soccer my entire life. I actually this year became a youth soccer coach as well. So I'm coaching. I'm also a soccer referee. So kind of like been a big part of my life, just been playing soccer.
That's awesome.
Now that I'm getting older, I've actually they tore my ACL recently, so I'm getting injured. So I maybe just transition towards coaching, ironically. I also really enjoy hiking, and like disconnecting from like just society in general. I feel like there's a lot of pressure and technology with society. And Colorado State's right next to the Rocky Mountains. So I'm lucky there that I'm able to just like drive 30 minutes and get away from people and hike. And then in terms of entomology related stuff, I wouldn't say there's anything too big in terms of a hobby. I like collecting entomology apparel. I
Nice.
got tons of different shirts and posters and whatnot, but I don't
Nice.
have anything like that. You get pretty busy as a graduate student. Gotta be a little selective.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, so moving on, what are some of your like big goals you mentioned with your PhD? What are some big like what are your big plans like moving forward? What are some more research you want to do, maybe trips you want to go on. What are your big plans for the future?
Yeah, so one of the main reasons why I switched to a PhD rather than just a master's is so I don't really want. So first of all, you need to do a PhD to do really anything in academia, but I'm not really interested in academia. I'm more interested in like government related jobs, so like USDA, National Park Service, EPA,
Nice.
and whatnot.
Nice.
And in those settings, there are hard barriers in terms of what you need in terms of education. So it's what you call a GS9 versus GS11. So GS9 is a master's level, GS11 is a PhD level. And when I was looking at all these jobs, when I'm kind of getting close to graduating from my master's, I'm realizing, okay, these jobs are super cool and super interesting, but I would never be able to go past that level because I wouldn't have a PhD. And I want to eventually, maybe somewhere down the line, be able to do my own research, read my own research questions, and so that is why I'm getting my PhD. And so after my PhD, I plan on trying to get that governmental job. Whether that's I'd love for it to stay within entomology. Like ideally, my dream job would be USDA Selective Breeding Lab in Baton Rouge. But those jobs are rare, and I'm sure I'm not the only one that would love that. So ecology, biology related jobs that hopefully are somewhat loosely related to entomology. And then another option, which is a common option, is just becoming a postdoc at a different university. Work there for 1 or 2 more years, get some experience, get paid a little bit more, which is always nice. And then you can reapply.
Awesome. Well, you got a plan A and a plan B. That's awesome. I love that. Yeah, so maybe India, did you say next year?
Yeah, so that would also be a great opportunity for me in general, just to expand who I know. Not right now, I'm very just US centric, but the United States isn't the only people that care about honeybees, obviously, or research.
Absolutely.
And who knows, maybe I'll love the research there and stay in India.
Yeah, well, you're keeping your options open. I love to hear that. So, yeah, so right before we wrap up here, go ahead and tell us where can we go to learn more about the work that you do, maybe maybe the lab that you are at, maybe their social media, or if you have social media yourself, just tell us where we can follow along and learn more about what your work is doing.
Yeah, so I'm technically, I think the title of my lab at Colorado State is the Social Behavior Lab. So if you want to know more specifically about what my lab focuses on and who's in my lab, you'll also see my name on there. Just look up Social Behavior Lab at Colorado State University. I highly recommend also looking into the graduate degree program in ecology. That's the program I'm in for CSU. Mm-hmm. That website has a ton of different options that if you're not just interested in honeybees, but there's tons of different research going on in my program that's entomology related. And then along those lines for my lab, my PI's name is Dhruba Nag. Spelled a little weird. It's Dhruba space Naug. Look him up. He does a bunch of cool research. And then in terms of social media, I'm not the biggest in terms of social media. Mm-hmm. But luckily, my name's fairly unique, so it's pretty easy to find me anywhere. Instagram, simple, just my name, Cord Dickey. So K-O-R-D, no spaces, D-I-C-K-E. And awesome. Then for LinkedIn, it's just type in my name. There's no one else. And you'll see me on there.
Awesome. Yeah. And I will leave the links in the show notes and the description of this episode. But yeah, I think that's about it. Thank you so much for being on the show, Cord. This was super interesting and super fun. I learned a lot about honeybees for sure. Yeah, so thank you so much for being on the show. This was super cool.
Yeah, this was a blast. Thank you so much.